Chapter 7. "Just roll up your sleeve, Mr. Redmond," the pretty nurse with the dark hair said. "This won't take a minute." She was holding the blood pressure cuff in two gloved hands. Behind the plastic face mask, she was smiling as if they shared an amusing secret. "No," Stu said. The smile faltered a little.
"It's only your blood pressure. It won't take a minute."
"No."
"Doctor's orders," she said, becoming businesslike. "Please."
"If it's doctor's orders, let me talk to the doctor."
"I'm afraid he's busy right now. If you'll just..."
"I'll wait," Stu said equably, making no move to unbutton his cuff.
"This is only my job. You don't want to get me in trouble, do you?"
This time she gave him a charming waif smile.
"If you'll only let me..."
"I won't," Stu said. "Go back and tell them. They'll send somebody." Looking troubled, the nurse went across to the steel door and turned a square key in a lock plate. The pump kicked on, the door shushed open, and she stepped through. As it closed, she gave Stu a final reproachful look. Stu gazed back blandly. When the door was closed, he got up and went restlessly to the window, double-paned glass and barred on the outside, but it was full dark now, and there was nothing to see. He went back and sat down. He was wearing faded jeans and a checked shirt, and his brown boots with the stitching beginning to bulge up the sides. He ran a hand up the side of his face and winced disapprovingly at the prickle. They wouldn't let him shave, and he haired up fast. He had no objection to the tests themselves. What he objected to was being kept in the dark, kept scared. He wasn't sick, at least not yet, but scared plenty. There was some sort of snow job going on here, and he wasn't going to be a party to it anymore until somebody told him something about what had happened in Arnett and what that fellow Campion had to do with it. At least then he could base his fears on something solid. They had expected him to ask before now. He could read it in their eyes. They have certain ways of keeping things from you in hospitals. 4 years ago, his wife had died of cancer at the age of 27. It had started in her womb and then just raced up through her like wildfire. And Stu had observed the way they got around her questions, either by changing the subject or giving her information in large technical lumps. So he simply hadn't asked, and he could see it had worried them. Now it was time to ask, and he would get some answers, in words of one syllable. He could fill in some of the blank spots on his own. Campion and his wife and child had something pretty bad. It hit you like the flu or a summer cold, only it kept on getting worse, presumably until you choked to death on your own phlegm or until the fever burned you down. It was highly contagious. They had come and got him on the afternoon of the 17th, 2 days ago. 4 army men and a doctor, polite but firm. There was no question of declining. All 4 of the army men had been wearing sidearms. That was when Stu Redmond started being seriously scared. There had been a regular caravan going out of Arnett and over to the airstrip in Braintree. Stu had been riding with Vic Palfrey, Hap, the Bruettes, Hank Carmichael and his wife, and 2 army officers. They were all crammed into an army station wagon, and the army guys wouldn't say boo no matter how hysterical Lila Bruette got. The other wagons were crammed, too. Stu hadn't seen all the people in them, but he had seen all 5 of the Hodges family, and Chris Ortega, brother of Carlos, the volunteer ambulance driver. Chris was the bartender down at the Indian Head. He had seen Parker Nason and his wife, the elderly people from the trailer park near Stu's house. Stu guessed that they had netted up everyone who had been in the gas station and everyone that the people from the gas station said they'd talked to since Campion crashed into the pumps. At the town limits, there had been 2 olive-green trucks blocking the road. Stu guessed that other roads going into Arnett might be blocked off, too. They were stringing barbed wire, and when they had the town fenced off, they would post sentries. So it was serious, deadly serious. He sat patiently in the chair by the hospital bed he hadn't had to use, waiting for the nurse to bring someone. The someone would try giving him the runaround first. Maybe by morning they would finally bring him a someone who would have enough authority to tell him the things he needed to know. He was a patient man. For something to do, he began to tick over the conditions of the people who had ridden to the airstrip with him. Norm had been the only obvious sick one, coughing, bringing up phlegm, feverish. The rest of them seemed to be suffering to a greater or lesser degree from the common cold. Luke Bruette was sneezing. Lila and Vic Palfrey had mild coughs. Hap had the sniffles and kept blowing his nose. They hadn't sounded much different from the first and second grade classes Stu remembered attending as a little boy, when at least two-thirds of the kids present seemed to have some kind of a bug. But the thing that scared him most of all, and maybe it was only coincidence, was what had happened just as they were turning onto the airstrip. The army driver had let out three sudden bellowing sneezes. Probably just coincidence. June was a bad time in East Central Texas for people with allergies. Or maybe the driver was just coming down with a common garden variety cold. Because something that could jump from one person to another that quickly. Their army escort had boarded the plane with them. They rode stolidly, refusing to answer any questions except as to destination. They were going to Atlanta. They would be told more there, a bald-faced lie. Beyond that, the army men refused to say. Hap had been sitting next to Stu on the flight, and he was pretty well sloshed. The plane was Army too, strictly functional, but the booze and the food had been first-class airline stuff. Of course, instead of being served by a pretty stewardess, a plank-faced sergeant took your order, but if you could overlook that, you could get along pretty well. Even Lila Bruette had calmed down with a couple of grasshoppers in her. Hap leaned close, bathing Stu in a warm mist of scotch fumes.
"This is a pretty funny bunch of old boys, Stuart. Ain't a one of them under 50, nor one with a wedding ring. Career boys, low rank."
About half an hour before they touched down, Norm Bruette had some kind of a fainting spell, and Lila Bruette began to scream. Two of the hard-faced stewards bundled Norm into a blanket and brought him around in fairly short order. Lila, no longer calm, continued to scream. After a while, she threw up her grasshoppers and the chicken salad sandwich she had eaten. Two of the good old boys went expressionlessly about the job of cleaning it up.
"What is all this?" Lila screamed. "What's wrong with my man? Are we going to die? Are my babies going to die?"
She had one baby in a headlock under each arm, their heads digging into her plentiful breasts. Luke and Bobby looked frightened and uncomfortable and rather embarrassed at the fuss she was making.
"Why won't somebody answer me? Isn't this America?"
"Can't somebody shut her up?" Chris Ortega had grumbled from the back of the plane. One of the army men had forced a glass of milk on her, and after that Lila did shut up. She spent the rest of the ride looking out the window at the countryside passing far below, and Stu guessed there had been more than milk in that glass. When they touched down, there had been four Cadillac limousines waiting for them. The Arnett folks got into three of them, and their army escort had gotten into the fourth. Stu guessed that those good old boys with no wedding rings, or close relatives, probably, were now somewhere right in this building. The red light went on over his door. When the compressor, or whatever it was, had stopped, a man in one of the white spacesuits stepped through. Dr. Denninger. He was young. He had black hair, olive skin, sharp features, and a mealy mouth.
"Patty Greer says you gave her some trouble," Denninger's chest speaker said as he clopped over to Stu. "She's quite upset."
"No need for her to be," Stu said easily. It was hard to sound easy, but he felt it was important to hide his fear from this man. Denninger looked and acted like the kind of man who would ride his help and bully-rag them around, but lick spittle up to his superiors like an egg-suck dog. That kind of man could be pushed a ways if he thought you held the whip hand, but if he smelled fear on you, he would hand you the same old cake, a thin icing of, "I'm sorry I can't tell you more," on top, and a lot of contempt for stupid civilians who wanted to know more than what was good for them, underneath.
"I want some answers," Stu said. "I'm sorry, but if you want me to cooperate, give me some answers.
In time, you will be... I can make it hard for you." "We know that," Denninger said peevishly. "I simply don't have the authority to tell you anything, Mr. Redman. I know very little myself."
"I guess you've been testing my blood, all those needles."
"That's right," Denninger said warily.
"What for?"
"I can't tell you. I don't know myself." The peevish tone was back again, and Stu was inclined to believe him. He was nothing but a glorified technician on this job, and he didn't like it much.
"They put my hometown under quarantine."
I know nothing about that. But Denninger cut his eyes away from Stu's, and this time Stu thought he was lying. How come I haven't seen anything about it? He pointed to the TV set bolted to the wall. I beg your pardon? When they roadblock off a town and put barbed wire around it, that's news, Stu said. Mr. Redmond, if you'll only let Patty take your blood pressure... No, Stu said. If you want any more from me, you better send two big strong men to get it. And no matter how many you send, I'm going to try to rip some holes in those germ suits. They don't look all that strong, you know it? He made a playful grab at Denninger's suit, and Denninger skipped backward and nearly fell over. The speaker of his intercom emitted a terrified squawk, and there was a stir behind the double glass. I guess you could knock me out, but that'd mix up your tests, wouldn't it? Mr. Redmond, you're not being reasonable, Denninger answered. He was keeping a prudent distance away. Your lack of cooperation may do your country a grave disservice. Do you understand me? No, Stu said. Right now it looks to me like it's my country doing me a grave disservice. It's got me locked up in a hospital room in Georgia with a buttermouth little pissant doctor who doesn't know enough to shit or go blind. So you get your ass out of here and send somebody in to talk to me or send enough boys to take what you need by force. I'll fight 'em. You can count on that. He sat perfectly still in his chair after Denninger left. The nurse didn't come back. Two strong orderlies did not appear to take his blood pressure by force. For the time being, they were leaving him to stew in his own juices. He got up and turned on the TV and watched it unseeingly. His fear was big inside him, a runaway elephant. For 2 days he had been waiting to start sneezing, coughing, hawking black phlegm and spitting it into the commode. He wondered about the others, people he had known all his life, and wondered if any of them were as bad off as Campion had been. He thought of the dead woman and her baby in that old Chev, and he kept seeing Lila Bruette's face on the woman and little Cheryl Hodges' face on the baby. The TV squawked and crackled. His heart beat slowly in his chest. Finally, he could hear the sound of an air purifier sighing air into the room. He felt his fear twisting and turning inside him beneath his poker face. Sometimes it was big and panicky, trampling everything, the elephant. Sometimes it was small and gnawing, ripping with sharp teeth, the rat. It was always with him. But it was 40 hours before they sent him a man who would talk.